I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We've all heard it before, money can't buy happiness, or buying a home is always a better investment than renting one. But is that so-called common knowledge always true? How do we know what's real and what isn't? Today, the smart money experts return. They'll dissect some common money myths and separate fact from fiction. Then we'll take a look at the Trump effect and try to figure out if and how the president's tweets impact the stock market. We'll also talk about the financial advisor's fiduciary rule in a new interest rate hike from the Fed. It's Money, Money, Money on Up to Date after this hour's news. President Trump tweets a lot. We all know that. But to what extent is he having an impact on stock prices? We're going to explore that with our team of smart money experts this morning. We're also going to look at a series of myths that surround the financial world. There's a whole bunch of them, don't you know? Here's one. Buying a home is always better than renting and always a good investment. That's one of the myths we'll talk about later on today. Our smart money experts are Sandy Weaver. She's a CPA, a certified financial planner certificate with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Sandy, nice to have you back.
Good morning, Steve.
David Jackson is a certified financial planner practitioner and financial advisors for Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. David, good morning to you.
Hey, hi, Steve.
Lucas Butchell is a principal with KHC Wealth Management. He joins us on the phone this morning from Western Kansas. Lucas, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, and you're out west helping your in-laws with the wheat harvest, which means you're a good son-in-law. Where are you exactly?
That's right. I'm on a farm about 6 miles north of Dighton, Kansas. So Dighton is about 80, 85 miles south and west of Hayes, if folks know where that's at.
Man, you are out there then. Man.
It's definitely very western Kansas.
How is the harvest looking? Because I know western Kansas was hit hard by that spring snowstorm out there. How's the wheat harvest looking?
You know, we're just getting ready to get the combines in the field this afternoon, so we don't have any real data in terms of, grain in the bin to judge it. I can tell you, just kind of took an informal survey with some folks yesterday and the day before out here, and they're expecting yields to be down. My father-in-law expects maybe 10 to 15% below kind of their long-term farm average due to the late cold snap and snow. And unfortunately, they had really been looking like it was going to be a good year. They'd had some spring rains, and the wheat was looking really good until they got that snow and cold snap there in April.
How important is a successful harvest to your family out there, and what is a 10 or 15% reduction in yield? How does that translate to what it means for them?
Yeah, they diversify their crops. So they farm wheat, which is a substantial amount of acreage, but they also have corn and milo. So it doesn't completely wreck the financials if the wheat crop comes in poorly. However, it's probably a good third of their farm, and so it matters. I don't have the specifics in terms of, how much a 10% reduction would mean in terms of actual revenue, but it definitely would, they definitely feel it and it put more importance then on the production that they get from their fall crops, which are corn and milo.
I'm just curious about what your contribution is out there, Lucas, because you're a financial planner. I'm wondering if you get in the way more often than you're actually helpful, or how does that shake out?
Yeah, I grew up in a very small ag community, so I know my way around the big equipment in terms of tractors or grain carts, those kind of things.
Oh, but, you say you do.
yeah, I do. But no, actually, I won't be driving any of the big equipment this year. I'll be helping with irrigation on the corn to make sure that that piece of the farm continues to go well, and helping with chores around the house in terms of keeping up on grass mowing and some of those things. So they don't put me in charge of any of the big stuff. In fact, they contract out some of the harvesting to custom cutters too. So
how much
less dependence on the family?
How much fun is it for you to get out there and actually help out a little bit?
Man, I love it. This is so much fun, and I have two young sons that are out here too, and so they get to experience life on a farm, and you know, riding around in a combine or a tractor with grandpa puts them on cloud nine.
Bet it does. Oh, that's great. Well, let's turn to some current events in the financial world and what's been happening there, because a lot of stuff is churning. Sandy Weaver, the Federal Reserve just raised interest rates another quarter of a point on June 14th. How significant is this?
It's significant that they're finally underway in doing it. It's the second of three expected hikes this year.
They sort of signal these things, right?
Oh, they do, yeah. More so now under Yellen than before. And it's just a 25 bit, 0.25 of 1%. So we're sitting at about 1 to 1.25% on the Fed funds rate. And that's still very low. It's not hindering corporations.
Does that mean higher interest rates for people who have money invested, David? Will that translate for folks who have money tied up in banks and savings accounts?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the other side of a two-sided coin. So as the Fed raises rates, it hurts you on the borrowing side, but it helps you on the savings side. The Fed is finally convinced that the economy is strong enough to, you know, stand on its own 2 feet. Inflation is still not up to the target that they're looking for, but the unemployment rate has gotten down to about where they're happy with. So the Fed says, let's get back to normal interest rates, which is somewhere around 4 to 5%.
And Lucas, there's plans now to what, for the Fed to slowly start paying off some debt here, or describe that for us.
Yep. So the Fed, when they when we went through the financial crisis and they went through all the quantitative easing to stimulate the economy, they really expanded their balance sheet. So they purchased a whole bunch of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities and really blew up their balance sheet. And so they've been waiting for the economy to get healthy so they can start unwinding some of that stimulus. And so there's been a lot of speculation in the markets about how they're going to do that. And so the Fed is just starting to reveal now here in the last meeting or two some of their plans in terms of starting to do that probably later this year. And they're going to be very gradual. So they're going to let some of those bonds that they currently own mature and roll off the books instead of reinvesting those like they have been doing ever since they bought them in the midst of the financial crisis.
Well, another development in the news when it comes to the business world, the Department of Labor choosing not to further delay the implementation of the fiduciary rule for financial advisors offering advice on retirement accounts. Sandy, translate this for me. What does this mean?
There, when you work with a financial advisor, there are two principles that they operate under. One is the fiduciary rule. The other is the suitability standard. So the fiduciary says, I have to give you advice that's in your best interest, regardless of what it is to me. The suitability rule means I only have to give you financial advice that's suitable for your situation. So I can give you advice, you know, buy investment A, buy investment B, but if I'm taking commissions, they're both suitable for you, but I'm going to tell you to buy investment B because I get a higher commission off of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that changes, especially if I'm working in your IRA or a retirement account. I have to now give you the one that's best for you, regardless of whether it's best for me.
David, is that the way it should be?
Absolutely, it should be. Now, there have been some controversies behind this, but...
Yeah, what's the controversy? Because it seems like it makes common sense, and it's about time that your industry got to this point, right?
Right. So part of it is just the whole idea of regulation versus deregulation. So part of it is like, do we want the government involved in all these different avenues? The other part is, though, that there are financial advisors out there who are, like Sandy and I, were certified and we're registered. There are also people that are that call themselves financial advisors who don't have the same credentials or licenses, but they're still able to call themselves financial advisors, and they're able to put people in certain products that maybe are not quite as suitable for them, are appropriate for them because of the suitability rule. So the federal government is basically saying, with retirement money especially, we're going to make everybody adhere to this fiduciary standard where things are in the best interest. One of the other things that had people concerned, though, was that the idea was that it may force a lot of financial advisors out of the business, which would not hurt wealthy people, but it would hurt people who don't have quite the assets. Mm-hmm. So there won't be enough people out there to serve them. So,
Lucas, you think this is a good step in the right direction here?
Yes, I do. I think it's a great rule for consumers, and that's ultimately, I think, what the government should care about. And and good financial planners should care about. So I think it's overdue, and I'm happy to see it come into place. You know, I think there with anything, there's no perfect thing for everyone, but I think for the vast majority of people, this is a good thing, and I'm glad and somewhat surprised, honestly, that it came through. You know, there was a lot of talk with when Trump was elected and the regulation rollbacks that this would be one of the first things to go. It has been implemented now. The Department of Labor has said they're continuing to review this and could potentially make some changes. But I think the fact that now it's the date has come, it's the implementation has started, and then enforcement starts in January of 2018. So I think the further you get down this road, the less likely it is that he gets walked back.
You know, not to belabor the point too much, Sandy, but why did it take so long to get to this point for your industry here? I mean, working in the best interest of your clients just seems to be something that should have been there for a while.
Yes, but it's in the industry's best interest to keep that suitability, to not let it come because it's easier to make money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, self-interest that was pushing back against it. You know, but it is in the best interest for the consumers. And, you know, how many consumers are there that come in like you? Your expertise is in a different area. So, you know, why would you have to battle this?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad to see it, too.
Okay. Let's move on to one of our main topics today. This is this notion of the president's tweets and the impact that's having on the stock market. You know, early in the Trump presidency, much was made about the impact of his tweets on the stock market of individual companies when he criticized the company via Twitter. We wondered how those companies have been affected. Has there been any change to this trend? Who wants to grab this thing?
Well, I think Lucas is going to be our expert on this, but in general, you know, early on, there was a fairly dramatic impact when he singled out a company, the impact of that stock. But lately, it's become he hasn't been quite as severe on individual companies, number one, and the impact has been really short lived, where the stock may take a drop for a day or two, and then it bounces right back.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, what would you add to that?
Well, really, it's less than a one night wonder. It's more like a 1 hour wonder when he does come out and tweet against a company. But Nordstrom is a really good example. You know, when they dropped his daughter Ivanka's fashion line. You know, that when that went down for like an hour, you know, or actually only 4 minutes, and it ended up, the stock price ended up 4% on the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I can, you know, give you far more examples, like Carrier brought those 5,000 jobs in, but again, that was a non-event in the end for that stock. So really, it's about a one-hour wonder, and then it's over, snaps back.
Lucas, it's fascinating to me, and maybe not surprising in this day and age, that there have been studies conducted as to the impact of the president's tweets here. We study everything in this country. What's your takeaway from all this?
Indeed, I think it. You know, the market had to kind of feel things out once Trump was elected and would single out companies specifically. The initial reactions, you know, would either be negative when he would attack someone or positive when he would pump them up. I think, as most Americans have seen with the Twitter account in general, you know, I think this is very unfiltered, and it doesn't necessarily translate to policy, right? And that's ultimately what drives stocks is, you know, the company's revenues. And so, you know, if it's one thing for him to come out and you know, go after Nordstrom's for dropping Ivanka's clothing line, it's another thing for that to impact Nordstrom's revenues, which is really what stock investors care about. And so I think initially it was a thing, but the studies have found, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Fortune Magazine, have all found that, you know, generally speaking, there's almost a zero impact. You know, he comes out and negatively criticizes someone. And even on the upside, you know, where he's praising a company like Ford Motors, for example, you know, you may get a little bit of a sugar high right away, but that effect is wiped out usually within a day or two. And so there's really not much impact on the stock price other than just a short-term blip.
Can you walk us through, Lucas, just briefly, some of the findings of the Financial Times survey of all this and what it found?
Yeah, so their studies, and, you know, they looked at all the events from Election Day through the time they did this, which was in February. And they said, on the downside, again, almost no impact. And then the company's you know, stock price within an hour, you know, was back to trading at a normal level. And so, again, just a very quick prick, but then, you know, cleaned up really quickly. On the upside, they found that it led to about a 1% increase, but that dissipated usually within 24 hours of the tweet.
And so bottom line is that the Wall Street and the financial markets are taking Trump's tweets with something of a grain of salt now, not as much impact as it was initially.
Absolutely, yes, because sometimes, you know, the stock will end up, you know, the reverse of what Trump has praised or dished them. So, yeah.
There we go. The impact of the president on financial matters. Okay, let's move on to our second segment now. This is Money Mythbusters, and personal finance is a subject where conventional wisdom and rules of thumb can be found almost at every turn. But many of these turn out to be myths that many people end up believing to be true. Let's explore some of the most common money myths with our smart money experts here. I think this one is so true that there are all these myths out there that you guys end up dealing with on a daily basis, I'm sure. But why is that, David? Why is the world of personal finance so stacked with myths?
Well, because a lot of the information people get is from non-experts. You know, you're talking at the kitchen table and somebody just blurts out something. Hey, you should always do this.
Yes.
Or you should never do
that.
Times. Yeah. And it's like, you know, without any education behind it, it just becomes just something people say. And I think this first one about buying a home is the classic example.
I think it's a totally classic example. Right. And this surprised me a little bit, by the way. And the myth is buying a home is always better than renting and always a good investment.
Yeah.
That's what I've always been told.
Yeah. And I had this conversation with a young man last week, in fact, who's 28 or 29 years old. And his mother has been bugging him about he needs to buy a home, you know, start building some equity. And I asked him, so what are your goals, you know, going forward? And he said, well, in the next couple of years, I'm hoping to move out of town and start my career in entertainment or music. And I was like, so why would you want to be saddled with a home, you know, if you're not going to be here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, you know, in 2 years, if you're going to have to turn around and sell it, you may not be able to get your money back after, you know, closing costs and commissions to the realtor. Maybe not a smart decision for you.
Yeah. You know, the other thing to think about here, Sandy, is the value of a home. It doesn't always go up. I mean, people are so caught up in the notion that it is always going to go up, but that's not the case.
No, real estate moves in cycles, and we've seen that. You know, home prices have gone down in 2008 and 2009, and lots of people were underwater, that phrase.
Yes.
That means your house has gone down below the mortgage value that you've got on it.
You owe more on it than it's worth right now.
Yeah, yes.
That's a scary place to be.
Right. So going back to what David says, if you're in a position that you don't know that you're going to be there long enough, you know, renting is a far better idea than owning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, buying a house, there's a lot of sunk costs just in the purchase. You know, we all know that. And then you have to hope that, you know, your appreciation either goes flatlines and goes zeros or goes up. But what you don't want to do is put yourself in a position that you're going to move out at a loss,
because mm-hmm.
you have to move if your career takes you someplace else.
You know, Lucas Butchell, you know, based on what David just said, this idea of buying a home, it sounds like it's better if you're going to be there for a while. This is a longer term investment as opposed to a shorter term.
That's correct. I always tell folks that you need to plan to be in that home for at least 3 years, and more preferably 5 years, before it's really going to turn into something that can be a positive thing for your net worth. You know, I think the closing costs that you have to get over matter. And the other thing that I think when they use this advice, they don't appreciate are the additional costs that you have to have when you own a home. Any homeowner will tell you that there are those additional costs to, you know, fix the air conditioner. The roof has to be taken care of. You know, there's always, you know, seems like there's something on the list for a homeowner to be taken care of. And those
Lucas, I got four words for you, okay? Tell me about it. I live in that world. Yeah. Yeah. So your point is?
My point is that you have to factor in all of those costs, not just simply the purchase price and the mortgage payments compared to what the rent would be, in order to really effectively make that decision.
You know, there is always something. You begin to wonder, based on what's happening here in Kansas City, Sandy, with all the condos being built, the apartments being built, if home ownership, if people are beginning to slowly creep away from homes because of what we're talking about here. And I couldn't blame people a bit if they begin to think that way.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is a trend. And going from single family homes to, you know, townhouses and condos. And those appreciate at a different rate and pattern than single-family homes do. So that's a new ballgame.
In what sense?
they may not always go up over time as a house has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are much more fluid and driven on demand and supply. You know, so that changes that pattern there. It's not what, you know, our parents experienced, so you shouldn't take that for granted, that buying a condo, you'll be okay if you hang on for 5 years or 10 years.
Let's go to a phone call here. Let's go to Iggy from Prairie Village. Iggy, you're on Up to Date, and our phone number, by the way, 816-235-2888. Option two is to tweet us, at KCUR, Up to Date. Iggy, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a real estate broker here in Kansas City over the past 20 years. And, you know, your topic was really kind of near and dear to me. So I just pulled up statistics this morning for Kansas City from our original Association of Realtors. And since 2010, appreciation has been going up, you know, in residential real estate pretty steadily. And if I recall the data, in Johnson County in 2010, that was the dip. That was the lowest that we, you know, ever recently went. The price was about $240,000 on average then.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it is at about $340,000. So
wow.
if you hold on to the property for a meaningful amount of time, between probably 3 to 5 years, you would be able to make money in the previous cycle.
And I respect those numbers. You're picking some favorable numbers here to work with, for
that's
sure,
correct.
Right?
That's correct. That's correct. No, these are the numbers for the most recent real estate cycle that we've been going up and up. And as we all know, real estate is cyclical. Mm-hmm. Real estate goes up, it goes down.
And it the is most hot right
recent,
now.
The most recent cycle has been going on for the past basically 7 years. And at some point, it probably will come to a stop. Either will flatten out, and hopefully we're not going to get a crash. So for those who are thinking about buying real estate, you have to look at it from a long-term perspective, unless you're an investor or a flipper who buys
right.
properties, rehabs them, and sells them. Otherwise, it's just going to be, as someone just mentioned, you know, a money pit. You will always
right.
have to spend money on air conditioning, on repainting, on roofing. And another thing is to buy smart. You know, look at a property that has, let's say, vinyl siding, for example, on the mm-hmm. outside that you will never have to paint.
Yeah. That sounds good to me. And are you seeing any move away, mm-hmm. Iggy, from people buying homes as opposed to buying condos or apartments? Maybe we lost Iggy there.
Looked like we lost him.
Yeah, okay. We talked about maybe there is a trend that way, and we'll talk about that more some other time here. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here about money mythbusters. We're going to talk about gold and tax refunds, carrying credit card balances, and this notion of whether money can buy happiness or not. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, we hear about the struggles of finding licensed, affordable daycare. We got a glimpse of life on the road as a truck driver. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR1 app. Tomorrow, we'll learn about the 1878 eclipse and how it helped bring America's scientific community together. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with our smart money experts, one of our regular shows here. We're visiting with Sandy Weaver, David Jackson, Lucas Butchel here talking about money mythbusters. Let's continue on with our list here, Lucas. The second one is gold is a good investment and it's safe because, hey, it's a physical asset. Is that the case?
No, I don't think so. There's kind of a mythology when it comes to gold, and you'll find folks, and we might even get some callers in, that really believe in it. And I always say that that's because they believe in it like it has some sort of a superpower. Gold is a commodity. It's not backed by earnings or cash flow like a company stock would be. And there's little industrial use. And so the functionality for gold is primarily a store of value. And that's a store of value that typically goes up in times of market volatility or uncertainty with governments. But just because it does that doesn't mean it's a good investment.
Should people, Lucas, should people generally own some gold and have it stashed in a safety deposit box somewhere?
You know, there's some people that advocate for that. I'm not a huge fan of that. You can go to some doomsday scenarios, in my view, where you've got, you know, let's say something goes wrong with the power grid and ATMs aren't working, and, you know, the currency system really crashes. You know, I think in that case, you know, would it behoove you to have some gold and silver? Probably. You know, you can run the calculation or kind of figure out what the probability that is. I suspect it would be really low. But in a extreme case like that, I think, you know, gold would have some value. And, you know, you can purchase it, I think, in small doses to help help insulate a portfolio from, you know, some volatility or a market risk. But generally speaking, I don't advocate people buy, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of gold and stash it in a safe somewhere.
Well, for me, a guy like me, this would be tough, Sandy, because, you know, I have to get a moving van to move all my bars
exactly.
of gold down the road.
Yeah.
That's in my portfolio, don't you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I think if
talk
you're
show hosts, you know, need lots of bars of
yeah.
gold.
Yeah.
We have
taking
those.
Your red wagon down to the bank with your gold bullion. But no, I think if you're going to do something to try to insulate yourself from catastrophic occurrences.
That's what it's for, you're suggesting.
Yes, I mean, yeah. And that's its value, that everybody thinks it's good in times of catastrophe. So as long as that mindset holds in the population, I think you'd be far better off to really diversify your investments and own different kinds of investments versus going the gold route, because it is usually highly unlikely that everything that you owned, all different kinds of investments, would be headed south during the same catastrophic event.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a better strategy to use and a far easier one to use than gold.
If our listeners have any thoughts on this, 816-235-2888 is the phone number here if you want to chime in or tweet at KCUR up to date. Any other thoughts on gold, David? And what do you do with all your gold?
I don't have any. But, you know,
the thought is, if we're going through some rough times in the economy, gold is a good safe haven to
right.
have some money. But,
right.
you know, historically, gold averages somewhere around what the inflation rate is, 3 or 4%. So
is that right?
It's just kind of a hedge yeah. against bad times.
Okay. Let's move on to another myth here from our Money Mythbusters list. Sandy, getting a big tax refund is a good thing. You hear people say that all the time. You're getting a lot of money back. You did good this last year.
It is not a good thing. You do not want to give the IRS a free loan of your money. You know, it is in. I review tax returns for our clients, and, you know, a good example, and this is a couple who has a big portfolio, has a huge IRA, and they I looked back 3 years, they were getting $30,000 tax refunds. And so when they came in next time, we said, stop doing this. Between the estimated tax payments they were doing and when they take an IRA minimum required distribution, they were sending that much into the IRS. Their refunds were that much. There's no need for that. You know, you don't mm-hmm. get paid for that. It would be far better just to use the safe harbor rule, and then which says pay in what you paid in last year, you know, that much, and then you won't get penalized. And then if you need to come up with more money, you know, if your salaries go up, then make sure you have a good reserve so that you can handle what extra you owe.
So, David, you wonder, so why do people say this all the time? You know, getting a big refund is a good thing. It suggests that you made a bunch of wise decisions during the last year, when Sandy's saying it's just the opposite.
Well, you know, people love getting money. And when you have a
yes.
choice of giving me money versus I have to write a check to the IRS, you definitely would rather
yeah.
get the check. But, you know, we just do math. We just do basic math. And so if you're getting, let's just say, $5,000 refund, well, that's $400 a month that you could have been receiving throughout the year, as opposed to waiting for the government to give you this, you know, $5,000 back with no interest earned
mm-hmm.
on your money. So
right.
it's just from practicality's sake. Now, we're not talking about people who get the earned income tax credit, which are, you know, if you get a big refund there, that's free money.
Mm-hmm.
But for the average person, getting a big refund is you just gave the government free use of your money all year, and then you get back with no interest.
Let's go back to a phone call. And I think Jan from Kansas City North wants to talk about gold. And Jan, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, just the one time when having a little gold turned out to be a really useful way to do things. Back in the Rust Belt days in 81, we needed to leave Ohio and follow the job, but that occasion was all down on the coast with the oil boom and et cetera. So we had a house, which we were lucky enough to find a VA assumption, you know, for. Otherwise, we were stuck. And had an auction, and the proceeds that we didn't need for the traveling, we went, you know, for we went ahead and put in gold. Then when we reestablished, when he, my husband found work in Houston, and we needed rent first and last month and all that, we found a gold shop. And it was a nice way to carry it without it being bulky, or, you know, we could hide it pretty easily. And it was, and we knew we were going to probably camp for a couple of weeks, you know, et cetera, which we did. So, yeah, it was a nice way of doing things and getting reestablished with our little fund. We had like $4,000,
right,
and some of it we kept in gold while we stayed because we knew we didn't want to stay in Houston.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So the next summer when our child got out of kindergarten, we went, you know, actually back on the road with an unemployment check every month because the company my husband got to was, you know, closed down, and we took Texas unemployment.
Okay.
So, while we looked for another home. So, but it could be handy for things like that.
All right, Jan, I appreciate that. Thanks very much. Let's move on our list here. Carrying a small credit card balance, Lucas, is good for your credit score. Is it?
Generally, no. So I think a lot of people get confused on the desire to use credit in order to establish a credit history. The most important thing about your credit history is paying your bills on time every month. If you do that, you don't have to worry about the credit history component of your credit score. So therefore, intentionally running a credit card balance, paying interest charges and finance charges on that balance, only to show that you can pay that off, is a bad idea.
Okay. Any disagreement there?
Nope. Absolutely right.
Yeah, he's right.
Okay. Number five on the list, money can't buy happiness. Sandy,
oh, that
explain
is so
life tier to me a little bit.
That is so true, because David and I were talking before the show. As financial planners, we get to see this every day, because you'll see a client come in that has a big portfolio, and they are no happier than the next day's client who comes in and has a far smaller portfolio.
Try me. Try me, Sandy. Come on.
Well, true. And the studies show that you need about $75,000 to have a base level standard of living to be comfortable enough. And then what comes in on top of that, there's no, you know, linear increase in the happiness level.
Mm-hmm. David, you buying this?
It actually, there's some studies that really support this. And there was another study that I'd read a while back that said whether your income was $30,000 a year or $200,000 a year, most people said, well, if I made 20% more, my problems would be solved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that thought of, if I had 20% more, that would take care of everything. But that 20% more just leads to lifestyle creep, and you find a way to spend that, and you still are in the same box, wishing you had a little bit more.
Yeah, what is it about that? I've been through that experience a couple times in my life. Like, you get a bump, and you know, you get in a better place, then you think life's going to be a whole lot better, and
Well, you think about all the commercials that are out there, you know, for cars, restaurants, better phones, better TVs. There's always something else you can do with your money. And if you have a little bit more extra money, those commercials have a little bit more impact on you. It's like, well, maybe I should get that extra thing, or maybe I should eat a little bit better, you know, and, you know, at the fancier restaurant. So it's just, you know, human nature, I think.
Well, Lucas, there's something called the happiness benchmark, and it's adjusted for the cost of living in every state, including Missouri and Kansas. Can you walk us through what the happiness benchmark is for Kansas and Missouri?
Yes, and so what this was part of a broader study on happiness and money, and it came to the same conclusion that Sandy had mentioned, which is, you know, on a national average, about $75,000 of income is the level. Once you get above that, there's not much, if any, incremental increase in happiness. And what these guys did is they kind of took it to another level and kind of benchmarked it for each state. And so what they did is they kind of went and looked at, okay, what level of income will provide that basic lifestyle needs to make you comfortable, where you're not worrying about kind of that month to month, the, you know, meeting your basic human needs. And so for Kansas, that number of income is about $69,600.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri is slightly less than that. It's about $68,800. And so those are more state-specific numbers to say, once you hit that number in terms of income, your happiness really plateaus and you don't get much, if any, additional happiness for earning more money.
So what you're suggesting, Lucas, is it's easier to be happy in Missouri than it is in Kansas.
That's true.
By less than $1,000 here. Okay. Sandy, let's move on to the sixth one.
In New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over 100,000.
We're talking about money mythbusters here. Let's move on to number six with our smart money experts. The percentage of stocks you should own in your portfolio should be 100 minus your age, Sandy.
Oh, yeah. This one has been around for forever. But if you think about it, it just can't be true. So let's say you retire at 65. That would argue that you want 35% of your money in stocks.
Right.
And yet there have been lots and lots of studies showing that because you've got a pretty long 30, 35, 40 year retirement phase in front of you if you're that age. You know, you're going to need about 50 to 75% of your money in higher risk stock kind of investments that grow and keep pace with inflation.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's just not true.
Okay. You're just not. Hey, where does this one come from, David? Is your family involved in coming up with this?
No.
Yeah,
you're talking about this percentage?
The Jackson family came up with this? No, this percentage of stocks you should own in your portfolio should be 100 minus your age.
That it was just a simple way to try to give people some context of how to diversify their portfolio. Is way too simplistic because everybody's situation is different.
Yeah.
You know, I've got some 60-year-olds who say, you know, I don't need this money. I'm going to keep it 100% into stocks because I want it to grow. I have some people who are in their 40s and 50s that say, I cannot take any risk. I'm just not comfortable with it, or
yeah,
I'm going to need my money really, really soon, so I shouldn't be exposed to the stock market. So everybody's situation is different.
Lucas, the seventh money mythbuster, spending money for a tax deduction is wise.
I hear this one all the time. So people are always looking for tax write-offs, tax deductions, and you know, to the point where a lot of times they'll make a spending decision just because they're going to get a tax deduction for it. And you know, it's really become a myth, I think, and the math just doesn't make sense, right? So unless you have a tax rate of 100%, that doesn't make sense. And so, you know, I always break it down for folks and let them know, okay, your marginal tax bracket is 30%. That means you're getting a 30% discount if this is a tax-deductible expense.
Mm-hmm.
But that means you're still fronting that 70%, and that's money that you're paying out of your pocket for this decision that you're getting no tax deduction for. So it only needs to be a useful spending decision if it's something that you want to do or need to do, as opposed to doing it simply for a tax deduction.
So the end of the year, when you get all these solicitations, making a donation just to get a tax break may not be the right move, Lucas.
Well, actually, that one might be.
It might be?
Yeah, because the tax deduction for a donation is dollar for dollar decrease of your taxable revenue. So instead of giving that money to Uncle Sam, you're giving it to your favorite charity.
So, Sandy, you're shaking your head.
I disagree. Yeah, because you're only getting a deduction. So really, if you give away $100, you're going to save, you know, if in the,
right,
you know, 30%, you're going to save 30% off your tax bill. You're still out the 70.
Well, if it's a charitable deduction, though, don't you get the whole full value?
No, that's a credit. You're thinking a credit.
Yeah,
that's
something.
Not a credit. You get a deduction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the final one on our list today. Medicare will take care of all my medical expenses once I hit age 65. Just briefly, Sandy.
No. If you take national averages, you're still, if you include a national average out-of-pocket of $1,872, you're still going to be paying about $6,300.
Okay. So skip
year.
That one, too.
Yes.
Okay. A bunch of good myths here. I'm glad we ran through them. I want to thank Sandy Weaver with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. David Jackson's with Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors. Lucas Butchell is with KHC Wealth Management. He joined us out west. Have fun out on the farm this week, Lucas.
Great. Thanks, Steve. I'm really looking forward to it.
You bet. Sandy, David, thanks so much.
Thank
Great
you.
To be with you. Thanks.
Greg Eklund, who covers sports for KCUR, is here to talk about the U.S. Open. He just spent 6 days at the golf course just outside of Milwaukee. And, Greg, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Steve.
How was it? What did you come away with regarding the state of the sport of golf?
Well, we've got to talk about my analytical interpretation of a golf crowd.
Let's talk about
it. You could walk around a golf course and you could tell what's going on at a golf course just by the sounds of what you hear. So here's an example of maybe a near hole in one.
Oh! Wow. Nice.
the wow factor, you know?
Yes.
The ball almost went into the hole, but it's an oh. So, you know, if you hear that around, you know, they didn't make the shot, but it came darn close.
How about the polite par cheer?
Yes, when they miss the birdie and the polite par putt. Yes.
Very, very polite.
Very, 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 very polite. There, you move on to the next
nothing
hole.
Nothing incredible there.
You know,
yeah.
And then you get down to the championship round when, you know, the big time putts are counting for big time moments. And then you get moments like this.
Get in the hole!
So you can tell what's going on in the golf course just by anywhere
listening.
In the course.
You could listen to anywhere on the course, and you can interpret and form your own interpretations by what you hear between the O's, the polite applauses, and the championship applause.
You know, I'm wondering, as someone who just spent some time at the U.S. Open, there's a lot of young and upcoming golfers taking over the spotlight while the public is still trying to get used to the prolonged absence of Tiger Woods and the fading careers of folks like, you know, Phil Mickelson, who's now 47. What's happening with the game of golf out there?
It's a struggle for the game. The game is clearly in transition right now, and you take yesterday, for example, Brooks Koepka. People probably didn't even know how to pronounce his last name.
I didn't.
Spelled K-O-E-P-K-A. Koepka is the pronunciation.
I'm glad it wasn't.
I heard all
today.
Kinds yeah. of things called out there on the golf course while I was watching him play. But these are good young players, but there's a recognition factor. Their personalities need to come out. And we haven't seen a lot of that in these young golfers coming out on the scene today.
So is the sport of golf then suffering when it comes to attendance and people showing interest here?
I think so. And a lot of it goes back to the absence of Tiger Woods, a major impact on the game in all sorts of ways, from the impact that he had because of what he accomplished, because of the recognizable figure with his smile around the world, maybe the most recognizable figure around the world since Muhammad Ali, it could be argued.
Does golf have anything close to that today?
Not anything
That's
close.
That's my sense.
I mean,
yeah.
Just take, for example, the last 7 major championships have all been won by a first-time winner, people that are not recognized, and some of those who have already faded and won't be recognized if they walk down the street today.
What does that say about the game of golf then? Because I don't have much interest in it. I'm not a golfer, but I did pay attention when Tiger was dominating the sport.
Yes. And a lot of it comes down to personalities, rivalries. You know, you had that Tiger versus Phil rivalry. So there was a storyline there with these new young golfers. There isn't a storyline developing because there isn't a rivalry developing between one golfer or two. Maybe we saw it with Rory McIlroy or Jordan Spieth, but it hasn't materialized yet.
So the personality aspect of the game of golf, then, you're saying, is critical.
I think so. They don't wear helmets like on the football field, so their faces are well-known, or you would like to think that they are. Now we need a little bit more behind those faces. We need to see a little bit more of the characters behind those faces.
Maybe it's important to review a little bit just how dominant Tiger Woods was back like in 2005, Greg.
Oh my gosh. His last major, think about this, Steve. His last major was a U.S. Open Championship in 2008. That's 9 years ago
Is
now.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable, and the TV ratings have suffered because of that. Just for example, the Masters, the TV ratings were down at its worst level in about 13 years, and that again goes back to when Tiger Woods was playing, and Tiger had such a dominating presence, like I said, and with the Tiger Slam at that time. And mm-hmm. these were things that had not been accomplished before.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could name 5 professional golfers right now.
Yeah.
I'd be hard-pressed to do it.
You know, and the other thing about it, Steve, is Tiger also offered the diversity of the sport. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see some Latin Americans on the scene, but again, you know, what he had brought to golf in the inner cities and the participation levels of the Gulf had risen to a peak in 2005. Those levels have fallen off severely in the years since.
How is the game of golf responding? Is there a response to all this? Is there a way forward for golf to address the media exposure aspect, the importance of personality, all those kinds of things?
Yeah, well, I could tell you just from a personal experience, just from the media exposure. When I was trying to cover the U.S. Open when Tiger Woods was dominating the scene, I was denied media access because there was such an international crush on the media exposure at that time. That
Greg Eklund didn't rank?
I was squeezed out.
Is that
out.
What you're saying?
That's right, Steve.
Greg Eklund from KCUR Sports?
I know, it's hard to believe.
Yeah.
But
in
now,
those days, you're saying you couldn't even get media credentials.
Right. They claimed they didn't have the space to accommodate all the media requests. And now when I applied for my media credentials for this U.S. Open at Erin Hills in Wisconsin, no problem at all. Welcome. I think that, and also because you've seen it from the newspaper standpoint. Golf beat writers are being pushed aside. There are no longer the number of golf beat writers that there were 10 or 15 years ago.
What else affects the participation level here, Greg?
Well, you know, the recession of 2008 had a major effect on the development of golf courses around the country. And if golf courses aren't being built, that clearly affects the participation levels. And, of course, the expenses are prohibitive for a certain amount of people at a certain level of income. I mean, it's something that is costly if somebody wants to take up the game.
You know, Kansas City's the home of Tom Watson, mm-hmm. obviously. Are there other up-and-comers from our neck of the woods that we might want to keep our eyes on?
Well, there was one Kansan in the field, Gary Woodland, who's from Topeka. He's a KU grad. He didn't play as well as he wanted to over the weekend. He did make the cut and got into the weekend play, but he is one of those. He's a two-time winner on the tour. He's in his early 30s now, so he should be entering around that peak time in his career. Robert Streb is a Kansas State grad. He did not qualify for the U.S. Open. His world ranking is not high enough. So he's another one who's still trying to hit his stride on the PGA Tour.
But nobody like Tom Watson.
Nobody. You know, I'm not sure if in our lifetime we'll see somebody like that come along.
That's Greg Eklund, who covers sports for KCUR. Greg, always good to have you here. Nice
Thank
job.
You, Steve.
You bet. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, how a total solar eclipse back in 1878 jumpstarted America's scientific communities. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.